Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis and uprocks.com. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. Today, I'm going to be talking with Jeff Blair. He hosts a podcast called Political Beats. It's hosted by the National Review. It's a music podcast, but it has sort of a political bent to it. Jeff interviews people from the worlds of journalism and punditry from the left and the right, and they talk about bands. Like, they dig deep into the discographies of different groups. It's a pretty cool podcast, and I wanted to talk to Jeff about that, but also this sort of general idea that I think that we're all dealing with right now, and that is, are there any bubbles that we can go into to get away from politics? You know, like, living in the Trump era, it seems like there's things going on all the time. You know, the world is constantly on fire, and if you're on social media, you're being inundated with headlines seemingly every hour on the hour that seem to suggest that we're all going insane. Other people have commented on this, but in the last, 2 years or so, it just feels like every week is a new year, and it's just exhausting. And it's nice to know that sometimes if you want to get away, you can go to a movie, or you can watch sports, or you can listen to music, which is my favorite thing to do. However, it seems like increasingly you can't even do those things. You can't go to a ball game because there's going to be people on the left and right arguing about whether people can kneel. You can't go to the movies because people on the left and right are going to be arguing about different forms of representation or which film should be nominated for the Academy Award. And in music, this has happened as well. We're having these arguments. We're using music as a proxy for political conversations. And of course, this is something that I've been fascinated by for a long time. I wrote about this in my first book called Your Favorite Band is Killing Me, which is a book about music rivalries and how we often will use artists and pit them against each other as a way to work out our own sort of feelings about certain issues in the world. That's not necessarily new exactly, but at the same time, just because of this Trump era hysteria that we're all experiencing, it just seems like things have reached a certain kind of fever pitch. And at the end of the day, no matter what your ideology is, we still live in the same world. We're still part of the same country. And there ought to be things that we can come together on. Regardless of what your ideology is, we can all go to a concert and rub shoulders together and sing the same songs together. Is this something that's still possible? So that's something I want to talk to Jeff about, because Jeff, he is, I guess, what you could call a never Trump conservative. So he's on the more moderate side. As someone who's been a conservative for most of his life, he's often had to deal with listening to artists who don't share his ideology. He's a big fan of Radiohead, for instance. And I was curious to find out how he deals with that, because I think on the left, being someone, I would identify myself as a, I guess, more liberal-minded person. I'm used to listening to artists that generally share my worldview, or at least that's what they're expressing in their music. So I was curious to talk to someone on the other side of the aisle about whether they can separate the artist from the art in that respect, as well as whether this is something that we could still talk about. Can I talk to someone like Jeff, who doesn't share my point of view on a lot of things, but who I know is a big music nerd, and likes to talk about discographies of bands and really nerd out about that kind of stuff. So I had Jeff on, and I think we had a really great conversation, and I'm excited to share it with you all. But before we get to that, I want to tell you about our sponsor for this week, and it is our old friends at Indeed.com. Now, when it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. Now, Derek, I saw you using this earlier looking for a new, what was this, podcast host?
We're looking for all kinds of hosts for all kinds of podcasts. There's no need to.
I'm a little nervous about this, man. But I know you're going to find someone good with Indeed.com. Now, when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. Again, that's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. So this was me and Jeff Blair. We got into it. We talked about politics and music and whether liberals and conservatives can still get together and argue about music without it turning into some fistfight about politics. And Jeff and I did have a really nice conversation. There were no punches thrown. There were no insults hurled. It was very civil and fun. So let's get into it. Here's me and Jeff Blair on the Celebration Rock podcast. So, Jeff, it's exciting to talk to you. You know, we've corresponded online a bit over the years, but we haven't actually spoken. And I always say that the only reason I have a podcast is because it gives me an excuse to actually call people up and talk to them rather than just typing messages. So I'm glad that we have this opportunity to finally speak.
I mean, it's great to be here on my end, too. You know, we constantly invoke your opinions on our show because both me and my co-host, Scott, find out that you have, you know, some pretty amusing ones. And, you know, maybe we're all in the same age cohort, but we do tend to align on that sort of Gen X,
right,
you know, shading into millennial vibe that you have on music opinions.
Yes, and I'm also grateful that you are here because I know you recently had your first child and you're still in the first sort of 3 months stage of parenthood, which I know is like the most psychedelic aspect of parenthood because you get no sleep and you're up all night and it's very strange. So I appreciate you making it through the haze to talk to me.
I have single-handedly altered the bounds of time and space, my friend. I am on the astral plane. I am truly I am an astral traveler, as Yes might say. The little bopper, the snort hog, as we sometimes find ourselves calling him, is doing fine. He's a handful, but my God, it's just a bundle of joy. I waited all my life to be a dad, and honestly, it's as great as it ever could be.
Well, that's awesome, man. Well, congratulations on that. And for this podcast, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds talking about politics because this is a music podcast and I like to talk about music. But just to establish your bona fides here, would it be accurate to describe you as like a never Trump conservative? Is that too reductive?
That's about right. I mean, I'm one of these people where, like, you know, now that he's in office, you just sort of like, you know, you put your head down and it's like you're running through a volcanic eruption and the stones are falling around you. Like, you know, like it's Vesuvius is exploding and you're unlucky enough to be living in Pompeii. And so you're just running towards the water and hoping that you won't get hit by like a giant chunk of stone. It's like flat. Because it's a disaster, and you just want to get through it.
Right. I was just going to say quick that, you know, we're recording this on Thursday, September 6th. It's possible that he will not be in office by the time this posts. I mean, who knows with the news cycle? There could be many things that have happened between, you know, today and when this posts. So I just want to say, like, if for some reason we are, you know, living in some Mad Maxian type post-apocalyptic terrain or something on the 9th when this posts, or the 10th, you know, just to throw that out there.
Yeah, we're still going to run this, whether he's president or not.
Right. Yeah, the podcast goes on, mushroom clouds or not. And I just want to say quick, too, I was reading a little bit about you. Is it true that you were like one of the first people to be called a cuck-servative?
Oh, my God, you found that article.
Yes, yeah, Mother Jones. Boy. I was like, wow, I'm having like a actual like history making person on my podcast.
Yeah, well, yeah, what wonderful history that is. That'll certainly end up, you know, like being told in the annals, you know, 100 years from now when we're documenting the Trump era. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's true, but it's, you know, it's just one of these things that happens on social media. I'm be clear, you know, again, politics is sort of – it's kind of certainly not the point of my podcast or yours. But, yeah, I am a conservative guy, and I found Trump to be obviously a rather egregious person, and I was not shy about saying as much online. And of course, that's going to attract the sorts of people who specialize in internet trolling. I mean, and I also have to say that I almost welcomed their hatred. I'm never like too terribly scared of these people because I realize that at the end of the day, they really are just ridiculous people who do it because they want attention or it fulfills some sort of bizarre, deep-seated need within them. And I I'm not bothered when they go after me. When they say mean things about my family, I do sometimes get a little bit pissed off.
Right.
But I just don't care when they insult me. I think it's funny. It's like, you know I'm going to be vindicated over the years. I'm not really worried about anything else.
Right, right. You know, it's interesting. You know, you mentioned social media, of course, being this sort of cesspool of trolling and all these, you know, people from different tribes warring against each other. And it has affected not just the way we talk about politics, but the way we talk about other aspects of culture, because politics inevitably touches all aspects of life, whether it be sports, music, film, what have you. And I know that you host a podcast called Political Beats, and you're talking to people in the political world, like writers, pundits, people like that, but you're talking about music. And I know that you've talked to people on the right, but you've also talked to people on the left. I'm just curious, like, in your experience, have you found that music is still a meeting place that's safe, you know, to talk to people? Because I know, like you and I, in our interactions online, I've never had a political conversation with you, but we have gone back and forth good-naturedly arguing about music, because you have strong opinions and I have strong opinions, and we'll kind of go at each other in that way. And at the end of the day, when you argue about music, it's sort of like, well, it's not that big of a deal. Like, even if we disagree, we can kind of shake hands and move on. And you don't always have that in political conversations. And I'm wondering, like, do you find that you can preserve music still as this bubble, or has that gotten harder to do?
Well, I thought we could up until this morning when I saw you saying really bad things about Arcade Fire's Everything Now on Twitter. and now it's in doubt, because I got to say, Steve,
where were you for the past year? That is like the latest in a long of jokes about Everything Now. I mean, that particular—
I know. You keep pulling at that scab. And
well, that was like a meta joke about me making, because like the idea was to, you know, like I think the tweet was like, what would be a characteristic thing that you could say in an anonymous column that people would know it was you? And I said,
because it's obviously something you've been hammering on.
Exactly, exactly. So it was right. It was more like a meta joke about me than about Arcade Fire. But you know, yeah, I've taken many, many shots at that album.
I think it's pretty good. I think it's certainly better than The Suburbs. But listen, I'm going to get back to your actual question, because it's an important one. And the answer is, I mean, obviously you know what my answer is. I'll give you two guesses, and the first one doesn't count. It's yes. Yes, I believe that music is still a place where people can meet. And if I didn't believe that, obviously I wouldn't have started, you know, a show and, you know, really gone, you know, as all in as I can in my free time on it, all along those lines. And I found it to be true. I found that, you know, there is a point at which, when you're a certain kind of music obsessive, when it really means something to you, you know, speaks to you in your life, you know, at that point, politics falls by the wayside, and it just becomes game, respect, game. Like somebody who knows every, you know, obscure crack of the Beach Boys recording sessions from 1965 is going to be able to have a really productive and fun conversation with someone else who knows that kind of stuff, regardless of whether the fact that one of them, you know, voted for Trump and the other one is a democratic socialist. Believe it or not, you can set aside those kinds of things, because if you love music enough, it's what you want to talk about. And if you're like me, you really want to connect with people on that level, because, you know, I'm interested in all sorts of things, obviously. You know, I'm an attorney in real life. I love politics. I love elections and things like that. But, man, there's nothing I enjoy more. And I have to be kind of careful about this in public when I'm talking to people in real life, because I can go really, you know, I can really nerd out. But online is a great place to nerd out about music, not only because writing is more conducive to it in the one sense, but also because people really start to find out that, you know what, even though I disagree with you about politics, here's a reminder that there are more important things in life than politics. And I guess one of the things that I will always reject, and there are people who will assert that, well, no, politics is everything. Politics is the most important thing. I can never get along with somebody who didn't see the same way I do on these most important things. I could never even be, you know, friends with that person or be in the same room with them. I'm not sure those people actually exist. I know there are people who will assert it, but I don't know if they really actually practice that in their real life, because I think it's impossible to behave that way. But I certainly don't believe it. And I've certainly found that, like, I can bond with people on the far left or the far right or anywhere in the middle, just as long as, hey, you agree with me that In Rainbows is Radiohead's best album, or you want to argue with me that it's Kid A or OK Computer. I'm up for that. And it's – the reason I created my show was specifically because the editor of NRO, Charlie Cook, came to me. I think it was sometime after Trump had taken office, you know, the first bout of all this insanity. And we were all tired of talking about politics. And, you know, and of course, I'd said this to him as well. He's a big music fan. He's a musician himself. And he's just, you know, I'm just sick of this. Why don't we just start a show that has nothing to do at all with politics? Let's make it about music, and let's make the joke be that we get all of these political people on, and that nothing whatsoever to do with, you know, like the stupid events of the day or anything like that. And when I announced it, like, the outreach was amazing. There were just tons of people who wanted to join and do it with us. And we have a backlog of guests who want to come on, because there's an appetite out there in this time, particularly, for a respite from this circus that you see going on, you know, outside our doors on TV, on Twitter, and things like that. So, you know, That's why I think that, yeah, there is a space.
Do you think, though, that with your show, that the people who are listening to it, do you get the sense that they're generally on the right and that they're drawn to your podcast because music coverage generally seems to be on the progressive side or have sort of like a leftist like slant to it? I mean, because I think it's not that extreme of a position to observe that, like, music writing generally is written by people on the left, and it has sort of that reflection of it, and that you know, that sort of informs how a lot of the stuff gets written about. Do you find that that's the case, that you have maybe more of like a right audience? And if so, do you feel like, because you're talking about how, you know, this is something that we can all meet in the middle on, but do you find that, like, the ideology that people have makes them maybe listen in different ways? Do you think that has any effect in that
regard? I think on a practical level, it's probably true that there are more listeners who are on the right than on the left, simply because of where we're hosted. You know, if you're going to find it, if you follow me, for example, I have a pretty a shockingly even breakdown of Twitter followers who are on the right and the left. That's you know, I'm honored. It's a strange historical circumstance. But, you know, at National Review, obviously, you know, you're going to go there, you're going to see a podcast. Why are you at National Review in the first place? Well, it's probably because you lean towards the right. So, yeah, I think that's possible. But we have tons and tons, because these people reach out to me and talk to me, of listeners who are on the left. In fact, I even see people tweet at me all the time. They're like, you know, like, boy, this podcast really infuriates me. I'm not supposed to like anything by National Review, but this show is really good. These people just talking about Jeff Tweedy for 2.5 hours. This is what I want out of my music podcast. You know, here's a bunch of Wilco fanboying, and they don't get that in other places. And the thing is that even if the audience leans more towards the right, I almost consider that to be a fun challenge, because that's why I like to bring on guests who are left-wing people. Like, oh, here's Chris Hayes, and we're going to talk about Beck for, you know, 2 hours. Or, you know, here's Jane Costin, and we're doing our Nine Inch Nails show. I'm going to expose people to stuff that they might have thought, well, you know, I would not have thought I was a fan of that. And I enjoy that aspect of it, because I think music is kind of – I really do stand by this belief that music is a language that has no politics, right? That on a purely sonic level, which is where I approach music first and foremost, you know, on the melody, sound, rhythm, production, things like that, there's no ideology there. There's no valence there. It's either good or it's not good. It either grips you or it doesn't grip you. It either has an intriguing conceit and presentation or it doesn't. It has nothing to do with, you know, the appropriateness of its politics. It's only sometimes on the most sort of stripped down and strident music, acoustic music, Billy Bragg music, maybe, I guess. I always use Billy Bragg as a punchline, which isn't fair, because he's actually pretty good. But, like, it's only on that where, like, you know, well, if you really don't buy into the politics, that maybe you're not going to enjoy it that much. But I don't have any problem really getting into something like Nine Inch Nails, for example, you know, even though, like, I don't know how political that music is, but it's certainly not what you would associate with, like, conservative Republicans, you know? Clearly not.
Well, and there was an era, too, and I don't know if this officially ended when Trump was elected, but there was an era where, like, conservatism was associated with, like, sort of morality, you know, this idea that, like, you know, pop culture is out of control, there's too much sex, too much violence, and that we have to squash that. And that was something that was associated with the right. And I assume that maybe there's still some of that out there, but like when you have sort of evangelical Christians voting for Trump, you kind of feel like, oh, maybe we're over that at this point. I don't know. But I'm wondering, because you mentioned that we're both Gen Xers. So we both came up in the 90s, and, you know, the grunge era and alt rock and all that stuff. And you're right in that music doesn't have an inherent ideology that, you know, if you listen to a record, you can enjoy the riffs or the beats apolitically. But there is a certain thrust to culture that happens, a certain maybe us versus them mentality that a lot of music takes. And certainly the music that we grew up on, the rock music of that era, there was sort of an anti-authoritarian stance that a lot of it took. I know that you're a big fan of Radiohead, and they've sort of adopted that into their iconography and a lot of the themes on their records, not always being explicitly political, but sort of striking out against ideas that maybe generally would be described as conservative. And I'm wondering, like, as a kid, I don't know what your political background was or your evolution or whatever, but did that ever impact you? Or did you kind of roll your eyes at that stuff? Like, did you ever sort of buy into that aspect of rock and roll? Because, I mean, that's certainly always been an aspect of it.
Absolutely, I have. And in fact, you know, I would argue, this is where you can really kind of run the risk of descending into the weeds, but I would argue that there is nothing particularly antithetical to somebody who is a conservative, you know, in regards to an anti-authoritarian outlook. I think I mentioned this to you when we talked about, you know, doing the show, and I was like, you know, for a long time, even when I was a kid, you know, every now and then somebody would ask me, you know, usually online, they were like, well, you know, you're such a conservative, you're a Republican guy, how can you be such a big fan of The Clash or Radiohead? Don't you know that they don't share your politics? And I'm like, yeah, you dipwad, I get it, but that's not the point. First of all, music at its best is something where the politics are more generalizable than that. You know, if it's like, you know, you've got to support the Black Bloc anarchists protesting the World Trade Organization in Seattle, which I'm sure Rage Against the Machine did a song about. I don't know Rage's discography, but it seems like the kind of thing that they would have done a song about. Like, okay, yeah, that's a little specific. And even there, I would probably say, like, is the song good? Is the melody good? And I can sort of just mentally set aside the lyrics. But you're right, it's something that gets a little more difficult to, like, wholeheartedly embrace. But on the other hand, does anybody have trouble embracing Street Fighting Man by the Rolling Stones, where Mick Jagger says, you know, I'll shout and scream, I'll kill the king, I'll rail it all at his servants. I think the time is right for a palace revolution. I mean, if you read that lyric, unironically, he's calling for a bloody revolution to overthrow the English monarchy. But nobody does. We just think of it as a Stones song, because it's one of their great Stones songs. You know, similarly, I don't think we take Brown Sugar seriously, because if we did, we would realize that we're all bobbing our heads to a song that unapologetically celebrates the joys of slave rape. So, yeah, that's a problem. But we do not process music in that way. We always process it from one step removed. When I listen to Radiohead singing something like Electioneering, or, you know, All Hail to the Thief, All Hail to the Thief on 2 and 2 Makes 5, you know, I'm not saying, oh man, he's hitting against, you know, George W. Bush there. I'm saying this song has messages that can work on multiple levels, which is what well-written songs do have, which is why I think music that's more on the nose is less effective. Right. I think of a song like Clampdown by The Clash. Now, if you know specifically what that song is about, it's about the rise of sort of like, you know, nascent brown shirt fascism in, you know, among the English working class in, like, you know, Manchester and working class areas of Britain in the late 1970s, right? But if you listen to that song coming to it the way I did as a kid in like 1996 or whenever it is I found London Calling, that song I could take it so many different ways. I didn't know what it was they were railing against. All I knew is that when I hear that guitar come cutting in and you know, strummer go 1, 2, 3, 4, is that whatever they're against, I'm against it too. Because damn, that's a good song. And that's what makes this music so great, is that music can transport you. And you're allowed to read in sometimes your own meaning. I'm careful about not trying to do violence to what it is the artist actually is trying to say to me. Because I feel that that's unfair. I feel like it's important to take a musician at their word. And if this is the message they wanted to give it, I owe it to them to understand that's what they're trying to say. But even then, the best written music, the stuff that lasts, is stuff that admits of all sorts of personal and, you know, more general interpretations, as well as like some specific political program. And so I've never had a problem reconciling that. I can listen to Bob Dylan singing about the lonesome death of Hattie Carroll in 1963. I mean, of course, first of all, who has a problem with that? I mean, that was a horrible atrocity. But second of all, I listen to that song and I think of that, you know, I can still identify with that song today. I think about, like, you know, a cop shooting, a black guy who has a gun permit and, is shot anyways because the cop is, obviously frightened, and then he gets off without being charged. And it's the same message to me. It's, somebody in a place of power gets off easy because of their privileged position in society. And I think, hey, that's the same story as the lonesome death of Hattie Carroll from 50 years before.
Right.
You can generalize these things all over time, and that's what great music allows you to do.
You know, when you were talking, I was thinking about Chris Christie and Bruce Springsteen, and how Chris Christie is a huge Bruce Springsteen fan. And I actually wrote about this in my first book. That's a plug, Derek. Plugging myself.
Well done.
Thank you. Your favorite band is killing me, but I went on a tangent about that because I've always been fascinated by that dynamic where Chris Christie's gone to like something like 140 Bruce Springsteen shows, diehard fan. He's from New Jersey. And yet Bruce Springsteen won't give him the time of day. Like when Chris Christie was governor, Bruce Springsteen like went out of his way not to shake his hand, not to meet with him ever. And you'd think that if you're the governor of New Jersey, you would at least get a meet and greet with the boss. But Springsteen wouldn't align himself with Christie because he was a Republican. And Springsteen is a well-known sort of Democrat. He's like a populist icon. And Bruce Springsteen actually like went on Jimmy Fallon and he sang a song making fun of Chris Christie and, taking all these shots at him. And, I don't sympathize with Chris Christie on any level except in a small way with him as a music fan, because if I knew that Bruce Springsteen didn't like me, I think that would kill me. Like, I would be devastated if this person I idolized didn't like me. But kind of getting back to what you were saying, the idea of sort of taking something as a listener, taking your own sort of message from something, because a lot of people would say to Chris Christie, like, how can you support or how can you love Bruce Springsteen when he's written all these songs sort of taking shots at Ronald Reagan and Republicanism and the things that were going on in the 80s. And Chris Christie would talk about how, well, when he listens to Bruce Springsteen, he hears a guy who pulled himself up by the bootstraps, and he was a self-made man, and he, epitomizes everything that's great about America. Like he took what meant something to him from Bruce Springsteen's songs, and he made the whole thing about that, which is, I think, what all listeners do, not just with ideology, but like when you listen to a love song, you might just take one or two lyrics out of the song that seem to apply to your own situation, and then the whole song becomes about that. I think we do that all the time, but it's an interesting thing when you also know outside of the art that the artist is sort of actively working against something that you would, be sort of pushing politically in your life.
I mean, it would kill me too if, for some reason I became famous and then Tom York were to come out and denounce me.
Exactly. Like he's read your blog about Radiohead and he's like, yeah, but this guy is a conservative, so I hate this guy. If he said that about you, that would be very hurtful for you, obviously.
I'm sure it would, but you know what? At the end of the day, the music would still stand. And I also, if I were feeling really brutal, I could turn it around on Bruce Springsteen and say, well, how does it feel that all those guys that you were writing songs for and writing about turned around and voted for Donald Trump in 2016? All those guys in Youngstown, Ohio, they voted for Trump after years of being ancestral Democrats. Do you feel like you've been repudiated? And the answer that he would offer, I would say, is no, because know, I meant it as one thing. I stand by the meaning of that. Similarly, the answer for a person in the audience is that I hear in my heart one thing. I take one thing from it. You know, even if somebody personally says that they don't like me because I come from the wrong political party, it doesn't mean that the music is suddenly bad, although on a personal level it just seems like, yeah, of course it would make you feel more sour. You know, I get by this by you know, not particularly caring too much about Springsteen after Born to Run era one way or another. I will point out, though, that even someone like him, like, it's so easy to take his lyrics and not think that they belong to one. He doesn't say, like, Born in the USA is not called Vote for Walter Mondale. It's called Born in the USA.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
It's a song about a Vietnam veteran who got a really raw deal, came back home to a job that didn't exist and doesn't know what he's going to do with his life. That is an American story. That's a human interest story. That's a story that anybody, you know, with a sense of empathy can listen to and identify with. That's not a story that has a political program necessarily attached to it, unless you then go that next extra mile and say, and therefore we must pass, you know, legislation A, B, C, and D, you know, and then of course people can argue about that. But to me, I listen to Born in the USA and I hear, you know, I hear a song about, you know, Vietnam veterans and how they were treated and, you know, and the country that they came back home to. I don't hear, you know, a five-step program of political reforms. I don't hear dancing. When I listen to Dancing in the Dark, that's about a guy who's sitting at home dancing in the dark. It's not about, you know, the need to elect Gary Hart, you know, senator from Colorado, which I'm just trying to pull out some 80s references here.
I like the Gary Hart reference. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, how long has it been since anyone's mentioned Gary Hart on any podcast?
I think there's going to be a movie coming out about him. There's a Gary Hart movie.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. And there's someone well-known playing Gary Hart. I don't know who that is. If you're on Twitter, tell me later, you know, any Gary Hart fans out there. But I believe there's a Gary Hart biopic coming out.
And so some people will tell you that that's a cheat. Like, oh, well, you know, you're really not, you know, wrestling and reckoning with the fact that, you know, this is a very politically left-wing guy. And I just say, I don't care. How much poorer would my life be if I decided what movies I was going to watch on the basis of the politics of the actors and producers and directors making them? How much poorer would my life be if I listened only to music that aligned with my, you know, personal sense of politics? I don't even know what I'd have left. Maybe, you know, certain chunks of The Who's discography and a bunch of country music? Well, no, I don't really want to do that. Okay, so it's just such a desiccated, an emotionally desiccated way to view life that you can only throw in with people who are part of your political sphere.
Right.
And it means that you're privileging the wrong thing, in my opinion.
Well, see, this is the thing I want to talk about. Oh, Derek, I want to chime in.
Hugh Jackman is playing Gary Hart. It'll be out this fall.
Hugh Jackman is playing Gary Hart?
Yeah, the movie's called The Front Runner.
Oh, my goodness. And he has blades coming out of his hands to get Donna Rice or something. Donna Rice was Gary Hart, right? Or was that Iran-Contra?
No, that was Donna Rice, you know, and Gary Hart was, you know, dared the media to follow him because he's like, you want something on me? You can send your reporters and follow me. And so the media dutifully did that and caught him hanging around, and this is legendary, on a boat called the Monkey Business.
Right, right.
With Donna Rice perched on his lap, you know, canoodling or some such.
And that's like pre-social media era too. I feel like if you got busted by the media cheating in like 1988, then that's like extra bonus points for you being an idiot because there was so, you know, less media back then. I mean, now you feel like, okay, everyone has cameras on their phones. It's a lot harder to get away with stuff, but
it kind of makes you realize what kind of dirt those televangelists had to really have been up to get caught. You know, like, you
exactly.
Know,
it was Jim, just like
Jim,
spilling
Jim Baker
out.
And Jimmy Swagger, man, they must have been doing some dirt.
Yeah, it was terrible, man. So getting back to the task at hand here, you know, what you were just saying, it leads up to something else I want to talk to you about because one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the podcast is that I felt like this was an interesting way to approach the separating the artist from the art discussion that has been very paramount in recent years. You know, because obviously we've been talking about that with artists who have committed terrible things in their personal lives. And even that has evolved dramatically in just the last couple of years. I mean, in terms of music, I remember in 2013, R. Kelly was booked to headline the Pitchfork Music Festival.
Yeah.
And if you went back, if that stuff is still up, if you read the previews of that, written by music critics, the majority of those music critics looked at that favorably or they were indifferent about it. And ironically, at the time, it was looked at as progressive on the part of Pitchfork to book R. Kelly because Pitchfork was traditionally an indie music site, and R. Kelly was one of the first sort of non-indie music headliners that they had. You know, and certainly, as if you look strictly at his musical resume, you know, he is a titan of R&B music in the last, you know, 25 years. Now, 5 years later, of course, people recoil in horror at the idea
now he's being deplatformed from streaming services. And
right,
the like.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the idea that Pitchfork would give him a platform, I think Pitchfork even apologized for booking him. And music critics, of course, if that happened today, they would line up and condemn Pitchfork, rightfully so, for that. But it just shows that just 5 years ago, you know, music critics who generally have a very pack mentality, you know, with opinions. I mean, the pack mentality of R. Kelly was favorable at that time, and it's changed, I think, for the better since then. So, you know, we all agree that if you're a criminal or you commit these heinous acts, that you shouldn't, that should somehow maybe disincentivize us from listening to your music. What I've seen, though, certainly this year, is this is sort of starting to bleed into people's opinions in ideologies. You know, Kanye West being an obvious example, this person who,
right.
I personally don't think that he has an ideology. I think he's a he's a provocative person. He's a showman in some way. I think he knows.
He's a troll.
There's certain things that he knows that he can do that will get attention. And wearing a MAGA hat, of course, was a way to do that. So you have Kanye West, you have Billy Corgan, you have Morrissey. Again, I think all these guys are sort of gadflies in a way. I don't know if they're true conservatives or if they've just sort of flirted with, you know, the Alex Joneses and sort of like far-right politics. But they've all had their sort of moments of controversy with bad pull quotes. And I've seen people talk about those artists not just condemning their statements, but reevaluating their art in the context of those statements. And, you know, like when Kanye West was sort of having his meltdown, you know, leading up to his last record, Ye, there were lots of think pieces written by people essentially saying that, you know, we don't know if we really should have talked about this guy being a genius, that maybe his music wasn't as great as we thought it was because this guy seems to be deluded in some way. And it kind of brings me back to what you were saying before. I feel like on the right, if you are a conservative music fan, that you have to deal with musicians who do not have your ideology on a regular basis. And like you said, if you only listen to right-wing musicians, it's like Charlie Daniels, Ted Nugent, and, you know, a couple other people.
Let's just say I'd be doing a lot of, you know, book reading.
Right. But on the left, you know, this isn't something that liberal listeners have had to deal with a whole lot. There aren't a whole lot of high-profile conservative artists, or if they're conservative, they're not public about it. You know, maybe they keep it to their personal life, but they're not integrating it into their music. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. I mean, it's interesting to me because I just think about my own biases. Like if I was listening to, say, The Clash, like you bring up The Clash as an example, like if The Clash had done like an explicitly, say, pro-life song, that would be kind of weird to me. Or if they did,
well,
what about
the Sex Pistols doing an explicit?
Oh, exactly. Yeah, you're talking about bodies.
Bodies, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Or if, you know, I'm just trying to think something like if I was a kid and like REM was as conservative as they were liberal at that time, like if you just flipped their political ideology and they had the same music, but they were campaigning for George Bush in 1992 and not Bill Clinton, how would I have felt about them? And I think I would have had a hard time with that. And in a way, because like what you're saying, I agree with about how music should be a meeting place and how music itself is not inherently political, but these sort of mental gymnastics that you seem very well practiced in on the left, I don't think we're as well practiced with that.
Okay, do you remember that classic scene from The Princess Bride where Wesley is facing off against Vizzini, you know, in a battle of the wits, and, you know, which cup is poison? Which cup is poison? You know, and Vizzini decides, like, oh, no, it's this one. He drinks it, immediately falls down dead after Wesley has drank his, too. And then the princess asks him, which cup was poisoned? And Wesley says, they were both poisoned. I've spent years developing a resistance to iocane powder. That is literally the position I think the conservatives are in when it comes to these things musically. I've spent years developing a resistance, a fact that, an inurement, a fact that I just don't care. I accept it as the lay of the land. It's the topography. It's what I expect. And I'm just, you know, I'm not surprised, and it doesn't matter to me that, you know, when, you know, musician X or actor Y or, you know, media figure Z goes mouths off and says something progressive, I don't care. I mean, it doesn't even anger me. It's not even like I'm like, well, that he's so terrible, but I guess I can get over it. I literally don't care. I'm pretty live and let live, you know, just as like almost all of my friends are kind of, you know, progressive liberal people, because those are the people who I live by and who I live with. I live in Chicago. Similarly, I just don't care. I'm used to it. I grew up in a very liberal place, you know, as a child. I live in a very liberal city now as an adult. These things don't bother me in any way, but they do to people who feel like they who have had sort of complete control over the levers of culture and has sort of taken it as absolutely accepted. They've had no exposure, or at least, you know, very, very infrequent exposure to people who are expressing different ideas than them. And when it comes from political or musical, you know, person or somebody that they idealize, then it really hurts. Then it really feels like it's a personal rejection. And of course, it's easy for me to say, well, how immature of you. And of course, actually, I do think that. I'm like, you know, get over yourselves, people. But it's always something I try to remind myself of, which is that it's easier for me because I grew up, you know, in the opposite perspective that most other people did. I've always been kind of a conservative person, even when I was younger, probably because I grew up in a very liberal background. And so, like, you know, I had a contrarian view on things. It's purely a function not of like, oh, well, these liberals are just spoiled brats. These people are, you know, little babies. They should get over themselves. if it was reversed and, say, culture was wildly, overwhelmingly conservative, media culture, musical culture, and somebody started, you know, mouthing liberal, you know, slogans and stuff like that, you know, you'd have the same thing happen with conservatives. They'd start freaking out. And that's what happened to the Dixie Chicks, for example, if you recall.
And I'll say, too, that I did see John Rich of Big and Rich, his sound guy, cut the Nike things off his socks this week because of Colin Kaepernick being in a Nike ad. So, I mean, there are extreme reactions on both sides of the aisle. I mean, I'm a huge fan of
this is all getting worse now. I mean, like, everything is accelerating. We're just heading into this bizarre, ultra-polarized era that, I mean, it feels like with Tom Petty, straight into darkness. It's just like, I don't know where it goes from here. So there's always that to keep in mind, that the timeline matters too. Things were so much different for us in the 90s than they are now, and or even in the 2000s than they are now in the, you know, the 2010s, which is a very crazy era politically.
I mean, and, you know, and I agree with a lot of what you're saying about sort of, again, I love the idea of music being one of these places that people of all kinds can just get together and we can all recognize that, like, What's Going On by Marvin Gaye is an amazing song. Even if you're like, well, you know, he had a progressive agenda with this song or whatever, like, doesn't matter. That's a great song. Or like Sweet Home Alabama, I think, is an amazing song. And it's written by, you know, a Jimmy Carter Democrat, but certainly later reappropriated by Southerners and turned into this conservative anthem. Even after that, I still love Sweet Home Alabama.
Or Bubba O'Reilly, which is, you know, the ultimate piss take skepticism on the entire Woodstock generation. It's
right.
Just teenage wasteland. Hey, that's a great song. Guess what? Won't Get Fooled Again? Really good song. It doesn't matter that it's skeptical of revolutionary values. People have long since gotten beyond those things.
But isn't there a moral component of music? I mean, I would say that one of the animating forces of rock and roll for a long time is this idea that this music can change the world. That if you write a song like, say, Ohio, that this is a song that can sort of galvanize people and get them to act against injustices in the world. And that you can't totally divorce yourself from that because maybe you're missing something essential about music. I mean, I know for me growing up, being a Bruce Springsteen fan, that influenced how I saw the world. Like, through his music, it helped, I think, give me a certain perspective that influenced ultimately how I felt politically. So, do you think you can really listen to your music, like, just totally divorced from that?
I think there's also a mistaken assumption here that conservatives who listen to music don't have ideals and don't want to change the world themselves.
Right.
I mean, I think it's the sort of this this assumption, this unexamined assumption, and I don't blame you for it. Everybody falls into it. Even sometimes I can sort of get back and fall into it, which is that we just all want to sit here and leave things as they are. Well, that's not it. That's not it at all. You know, we have our vision, of an ideal society, and it's not like, oh, yes, where the poor suffer in pain and the rich are just unrewarded, completely disproportionate to the actual effort or value they create in society. It's not that kind of stupid caricature. No. I have a very ordered vision of what I consider to be an ideal society, and I really would like to, change the world to reflect that. That's the same, activist impulse that, any, young radical leftist has. It's just expressed in a different manner. And so if you Right. have that thing, you can find those impulses in all sorts of music. And I'll, by the way, point out that, Neil Young wrote Ohio about 10 soldiers in Nixon Common, 4 dead in Ohio. And then six years later, he wrote Campaigner.
Right.
All right. Which is, where even Richard Nixon's got soul, saying, I was probably – I think he wrote it when he saw Nixon leaving the hospital where his wife, Pat, had been hospitalized, I think, for some problem, some disease, and he was crying. And he thought, I think I must have been unfair here. I have to really reevaluate the way I demonize people. And then 4 years after that – he's writing flipping Hawks and Doves, like Union Man and Coming Apart at Every Nail and songs about Reaganite politics.
Right.
So people change. And even these artists themselves aren't always on the same map. Well, let's talk about Bob Dylan's various zigs and zags.
Right, exactly. When I think, again, it comes back to how a lot of great artists are contrarians, I think, ultimately. Or they side with things that they feel like are maybe underrepresented, and then they end up sort of supporting that. Like, I'm sure Neil Young at points felt like he was probably reacting to whatever was happening in Los Angeles at that time. And he's like, well, I don't, especially someone like Neil Young, who's such an irascible personality, he probably felt like everyone around me just is dehumanizing Richard Nixon. So I'm going to write this song that humanizes Richard Nixon because that's what I do. And I'm going to be different from the pack no matter what. And I agree with you. I didn't mean to suggest that conservatives don't want to change the world or aren't idealistic, but I think
you've keyed in on something. The art is empathy. A great artist and a great art is empathetic. It's not even about just the politics. It's about having an emotional connection to something. And that's why Neil Young does that, for example. And that's why a conservative can relate to somebody who's a liberal with a liberal story to tell, because the empathy is there.
You mentioned at the beginning that you feel like music is still this place where different kinds of people can get together and talk about music and geek out about music, even if they may disagree in other areas. And I'm wondering if that is starting to go away a little bit, because I feel as though conversations about music, at least in the media, have deviated from aesthetics into more of a, I guess, political conversation and talking about artists who may not even themselves be inherently political, but putting them in this political context. Like, to me, I think about Taylor Swift.
I was going to say Taylor Swift.
Because, Taylor Swift is an artist who, if you look at her songwriting, I don't think that there's really any real political message at all, unless you want to say that feminism is, pervasive in her songs. Like, maybe that would be the closest that she would veer into that. But I don't feel like she is really that kind of artist. I think she is an entertainer. I think she's a great entertainer, and she's writing great pop songs to be played on the radio and to be played in stadiums. I think that is what she does. And there was, of course, this controversy with her that a lot of people felt that she should have been more active during the election of 2016, that she didn't come out. And I mean, I think she might have did an Instagram post where she suggested that she was supporting Hillary Clinton, but she wasn't as active as certainly as she could have, or someone like Katy Perry, I think, was, another pop star, certainly, were much more active than she was. And there seemed to be this sort of expectation out there that she take a political stance, even though, again, she had never really demonstrated that in her art before. And my feeling is always that if you feel compelled to speak out in your art, then you should feel free to do so, especially if you can turn it into great art. Like Ohio, again, I think is a strong political statement, but it's also just a great song. Like, even if you ignored the lyrics, the music is really great. And I think that's always the best kind protest song. You mentioned The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll being another. That's just a great song. It's a
fantastic song.
It's a political song, but as a song itself, it doesn't just rest on the message in the way that, say, like Living with War, that Neil Young record from 2006, which is just pure message. And the music was sort of purposefully generic. Like Neil Young talked about how he didn't want to have sophisticated songs on there because he thought the message was so important. But it really kind of makes that record sound like a blog post.
Can I mention another one that always jumps out to me? Because I'm a pretty pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun kind of a guy. But I'll tell you, a Pearl Jam song that I absolutely love is Glorified G off of Versus.
Right.
You know, glorified version of a pellet gun. You know, it's basically a song that's making fun of their drummer for buying a gun. Anti-gun song. And I love that song to death. Not only because of the music, because I think the lyrics are just funny. I was like, if you're going to package, like, you know, an anti-gun message into a song, this is the way to do it because he sells it. Rare for Pearl Jam, by the way. Not a band you associate with humor, right?
Right.
But man, Eddie Vedder just sells the crap out of that with just a, not only fantastic music, but fantastic funny lyric too about like, yo, look at me, I'm so macho, I'm so masculine now that I have my gun, you know? That's really successful political music. And I don't have to agree with the message to think that at all.
But I mean, you know, I was on this rambling point about Taylor Swift. I mean, my essential point was to say that, and you hit on this. No, that was good. I like bringing up Glorified G in any context. But no, I mean, because you were saying before, and I agree with this, that not everything has to be political. I think some things are bigger than politics. I believe in sort of the power of art, and the power of music. Being this sort of gift that we all have, and that this is something that we should be able to enjoy, I think that politics has a place in music, especially again when artists feel compelled to do it. But I feel like we're reaching a point where it's almost being shoehorned in sometimes. I've read concert reviews that were criticizing Taylor Swift for not calling out white supremacists who supposedly like her music, which I would say every artist has white supremacists in their fan base, because if you are famous enough, if you're famous enough to play a stadium, a good section of those people are not going to be good people, you know, just by the law of averages. So to expect any artist to condemn the jerks in the audience, like at every show, I just think is unfair.
And I think there's a really pernicious element to modern media culture that politicizes everything about art, entertainment, sports. Everything has to be politicized. And I think a large amount of this is driven by the internet, the advent of social media. My longstanding thesis is that social media is a whole, and it's ruining us as people. This is very hypocritical and ironic of me, because I've benefited immensely from, like, you know, my Twitter account, for example. But it's just people now search for clicks. They search for controversy. They search for heat. So what do all these striving people working in low-level media jobs who have to write articles where they get paid metered, you know, on how many clicks they get? Well, the easy answer is to, you know, what's hot? What's hot? Politics, especially in the age of Trump, is always hot. So they write an article with a political angle, or they say like, oh, this is insufficiently woke, or oh, this falls afoul of, you know, these four different, you know, particular issues that will get people to click, that will get angry commentary, that'll get even just people like, you know, retweeting it and rolling their eyes. It's a vicious cycle, because that's what will drive traffic, and therefore that's all that gets written about. Even if the people who are writing about it and even the people who are reading a bit don't really care that much about it. And so it then seems to be the only thing that people talk about. But it's just so pernicious, this idea of the politicized life, that everything's got to have a political valence. Taylor Swift is writing a song called Shake It Off so you can get up and dance and enjoy yourself. There's no need to have like a political message behind it. You know, when I listen to, you know, everyone from, you know, Bon Iver to your latest R&B sensation on the charts. I don't need to know whether the person presenting it to me is politically correct and appropriate or not. I don't really care about their views on LGBT issues. And this, by the way, reminds me of another story. You remember that band Power Bottom? You remember them, Stephen?
Oh, yeah. Yes, exactly. I mean, this is a band that fell down a memory hole, essentially.
Yes.
And I remember I actually wrote about their second record. It was called Pageant. It came out in May of 17. And I remember I wrote a positive review of the record. It came out on a Wednesday. And by Friday, that record did not exist anymore. And that band did not exist. Like, they were wiped off the face of the planet, which was an incredible thing. And it was because of accusations of sexual assault against one of the band members, which is a terrible thing. I think that's an interesting story because this all, you know, because again, like this band, they got a lot of great attention because because
they were so like, you know, on board with like, you know, LGBT empowerment.
Right.
And I was like, great. Actually, I liked their music. I thought it was good music. That was what I was into it for. But yeah, and then. Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. Can you tell the story? Because I think a lot of people, because again, they've been memory holds.
Well, yeah, it's one of those stories where I think every step of the way you could justify the actions that were taken because these accusations came out and the record label said, well, we don't want to put the record out. And their manager said, well, we don't really want to work with this band. And venue said, well, we don't really want to book this band at our venue. And, you know, you can justify each one of those decisions. You know, yeah, like a label shouldn't be forced to put out a record that they don't want to put out. And you shouldn't be forced to stay with, you know, booking a band if you feel like they've done terrible things. But it resulted in this very weird thing, sort of an Orwellian thing, where they just don't exist anymore. The record is gone.
And like, I periodically Google them
to
see if there's any new news. There's like literally no one has – you can't even find their name with an article about them since the middle of 2017. It's like spooky actually.
And
it's very weird.
By the time it's like 2020, you know, people are not going to know that this band existed. And maybe that's a good thing. However, there will be other bands that have scandals like this in their background. And I think there is an interest in preserving the history – to some degree, you know, that people, so people know that this happened and that these are the consequences, if only to say, hey, you know, don't screw around if you're in a band. Do not assault women. Do not do these terrible things because this can happen to your career. It's almost like the lesson of what that band was has been wiped away as well.
The music wasn't about that. The music wasn't about the joys of sexually assaulting women. I mean, to an extent that the music was about anything other than like really catchy power pop, which is why I like them.
Right.
It was about like, you know, as I said, it's like, you know, a gay, transsexual, transgender empowerment agenda, which is fine. You know, certainly, you know, very appropriate in the modern era. Just because one of the members of the band happened to be, as it turns out, I mean, I guess I don't want to assume that the accusations are true, but he was alleged to have been, you know, a bad guy. It doesn't render the music bad. Hey, do we want to really kind of like break down all the bad things that Led Zeppelin's band members
right.
were up to during the 70s or the Stones or David Bowie? Because, you know, we could really dive down that rabbit hole and then all of a sudden we're not allowed to listen to Heroes or Physical Graffiti anymore. I don't think people will really have an appetite for that.
Yeah, I mean, and again, it's kind of, you know, again, the artist from the artist, the art from the artist question, which, again, like 5 years ago, I remember I wrote about R. Kelly playing Pitchfork, and I wrote the premise of my column was basically that our stances on these sorts of issues, when we know about sins in an artist's personal life, it tends to be situational, that it's hard to be consistent across the board to have one stance on like, well, if you do this, then I don't like you. And I use those examples that you mentioned, that there are so many great artists that, like if you're talking about like artists from the 70s, chances are that they dated an underage girl at some point. I mean, it's just something that, like, it seems like every major rock star did at that time. And I wasn't, you know, an adult in the 70s. I don't know what the standards were at that time. It seems like maybe things were more permissive with that? I don't know. I mean, it seems like it was much more out in the open at any rate back then. Whereas now we look at that and it's horrifying. But it seems like those artists haven't really gotten their reckoning yet. I don't know if that will happen or not. That'll be an interesting thing to see as we go forward. I always feel like the best way with those sorts of things is to not whitewash the stories, to make that part of the historical record with these artists when we talk about their personal histories. But we also maybe don't totally chuck it in the garbage either, you know.
I don't know about you, Steve. I really liked the song Layla until I found out that Jim Gordon murdered his mom and then Eric Clapton got you know, conservative views about immigration, and now I just think it's a piece of garbage.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's just like stupid. You have to take the music for what it is, and like, yes, this, by the way, like, you know, another thing to point out, which you kind of got at, is that the rock world tends to attract a lot of sketchy characters. We just did an episode on our show on Guns and Roses. I mean, holy crap, we had to have a long discussion about One in a Million.
Right.
Just, you know, among all the other shady things that Axl Rose and, you know, no doubt any other members of the band have been up to. You know, does that mean that Appetite for Destruction is a bad album? Of course not. Appetite for Destruction is a great album. I still like November Rain a lot. It doesn't make these songs bad, even if you recognize that, you know, I wouldn't want Axl Rose to move in next door to me. You just have to separate the art from the artist in that sense.
Well, Jeff, I feel like we could talk about this for a really long time, but I think we're cutting out. Okay, we got to end it now. But yeah. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I hope to have you back again sometime.
Boy, it would be my pleasure, and thank you for having me on. And by the way, if I can put a plug in here, everybody go listen to Political Beats on National Review Online. You can subscribe to it on iTunes. And, you know, me and my co-host, Scott Bertram, we really nerd out.
Okay, man. Well, hey, thanks again, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Hey, take care. All right, so that was me and Jeff Blair from the Political Beats podcast. Again, that's hosted by National Review Online, if you want to go check that out. Thanks again to Jeff for coming on the pod. That was a lot of fun. Got to give a shout out to the man who makes it happen, Derek Madden. Thank you for producing the pod, Derek. Also got to give a shout out to the guy who wrote our theme song, Josh Copperman. Is it Josh Copperman?
Yep.
Thank you. I just want to see Derek Copperman. I just want to make him your unofficial brother.
Just on your mind.
He's just on my mind. Derek is always on my mind. Thank you, Josh, for writing our theme song. And thanks, of course, to all of you, our Celebration Rock Pod listeners, for your support. We got a lot of great feedback for our Christian Rock DC Talk episode with Riley Walker. I actually got a lot of emails from people talking about their Christian Rock pass. So that was a lot of fun. I feel like we're going to have to do another Christian Rock podcast at some point, maybe delve into Jars of Clay. Guys, thanks again for listening to this episode. We will be back again next week with more Celebration Rock. Take care.
On the Westwood One Podcast Network.
John brings his skewed sense of humor. Jeff brings tips to cut strokes off your next round. Together, it's those weekend golf guys.
They'll pay a lot of money to PXG and Titleist and Callaway and on and on and on, right? How many yards do you think you're going to pick up with that extra driver? I think I can get an extra 5 to 10. What if I give you 15 to 20? Can you pay me more?
Jeff Smith, right? Teaches on the sliding scale.
Those weekend golf guys, the podcast, part of the Believe Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen.